Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Uprising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power, and we shine the light ahead of us on the path where evolution is leading. Purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right front and center, to face the music, and dance together, if possible, to address problems instead of just defending positions. Well, our cohort Swami Beyondananda says those who fail to learn the lessons of history condemn the rest of us to repeat it. And I'm a student of history, as is my guest today, Tom Hartman. It always amazes me how much content we're subjected to and how little context. Fortunately, as we will soon find out, Tom is a great contextualizer and an uncommentator, a voice in the bewilderness. We'll be talking about his latest book, The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment. And having read the book, I look forward to Tom spraying this very confused and distorted issue with what we call demystifier. He's going to spray it with demystifier. Now, some of you might remember that back in the 1960s, Black Power activist H. Rap Brown famously said, "Violence is as American as cherry pie." Now, of course, there are some differing opinions on this. There are those who say violence is as American as apple pie. So we'll have to decide which is true. In any case, as Tom points out in his book, guns have been part of our political legacy since the day Columbus landed and since the first slaves were brought into the New World from Africa. As part of the doctrine of discovery, the conquistadors were given carte blanche by Pope Alexander during the 1400s in his papal bull to kill, rape, exploit, and plunder non-Christian people who were deemed less than human. According to Tom in his book, on his second visit to Hispaniola, Columbus made 1,600 local villagers slaves at the point of a gun. And I want to share one more shocking statistic from the book. In 1992, historian David Stannard estimated that some 100 million native peoples in this continent had been killed through murder, disease, and starvation since they had been, quote-unquote, discovered. Now, I certainly hope nobody ever discovers me. For those who don't know Tom Hartman yet, he's a lifelong learner. He's a wise teacher. His books range from books on fossil fuels, like The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, which is when I first met him 20 years ago, to books on Thomas Jefferson and the founders of America, to books on attention deficit disorder and what he calls the Edison gene. Tom is a progressive national and internationally syndicated talk show host. Talkers magazine named him America's most important progressive host and has named his show one of the top 10 talk radio shows in the country every year for over a decade. He's a four-time recipient of the Project Censored Award. He is also a New York Times best-selling author of 24 books translated into multiple languages. So welcome, Tom. It is a pleasure to have you.
Hey, Steve. It's an honor to be on your program. Thanks for inviting me.
Good. Now, Tom, you've written a lot of books on a wide variety of topics. I'm curious, what spurred your interest in this topic of guns?
Well, number one, it's something that, my show is largely politics, and guns have become, they've shifted out of becoming just, a tool, even a social, form of identity. And that's, of course, setting aside the whole issue of the small penis gun club, into a political issue. I mean, actually, I own the URL smallpenisgunclub.com.org and I think .net. So
people are going to be rushing to join that one, or at least to see who belongs.
I'm telling you, we started a Small Penis Gun Club Facebook page and a Small Penis Gun Club Twitter account, and they've got tens of thousands of followers in both of them. So setting all that aside, it's basically become guns have become a political weapon that, no pun intended, that the Republican Party has been using for years and years. And so I really couldn't escape or avoid the issue, broadly speaking, just on, in my day to day work, as it were, doing a radio show every day. And then, number one. Number two, we had 40,000 people die from guns last year in the United States. That's a public health epidemic. If 40,000 people were dying from SARS or from Ebola, we'd be in, or even tuberculosis, we'd be hysterical right now. Instead, it's like something that people, I guess that's the price of freedom, right? As Sean Hannity would say. And then third, when I was 19, my very, very closest friend, one of the closest friends I ever had in my life, committed suicide with a gun after he got drafted. And so I've, the issue, and I grew up around guns. Most of my friends hunted. I grew up in Michigan, and people would go up north and go hunting in the fall. I never did. I was never a hunter. One of my brothers has a number of guns. He's got a shooting range in his backyard. He lives way out in the middle of nowhere. And so for decades, and I enjoy target shooting. He's a vegetarian, as am I. He doesn't go hunting. So for decades, we go back to Michigan and stay with my brother and for fun. He and I and sometimes our other brothers or some of our kids will get together and do target shooting in his backyard. So, my life has been, my mom had a .22 when I was a little kid. I think she got rid of it my next to the youngest brother was born. I never saw it again after I was about five or six. And my parents gave me BB guns and cap guns and stuff. We grew up watching Westerns. It's been part of my life. And so I wanted to write a book about guns.
It's interesting. I learned a lot reading the book. I appreciate the historical context that you provide because, again, these days, everything is really about current events and tweets that happen today. And very conveniently, the media kind of keeps us away from contextualizing these. And I'm particularly the role that guns played in subjugating and eradicating the native peoples and enforcing slavery. So here's a blunt quote from your book, quote, "America was birthed in slavery and genocide, and both needed guns," unquote. So expand on that a little more.
Yeah, the guy who really, two guys who really woke me up to this were Jared Diamond and Jack Forbes. Jared Diamond wrote a book called Guns, Germs, and Steel, in which he pointed out that guns, this kind of superior military technology, made the genocide of Native Americans in North America, colonization, I guess, of Central and South America. It wasn't really functional colonization happened in the northern half of Africa anyway. But the colonization of much of the New World rather, possible. And then Jack Forbes, when I was writing Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight back in the early 1990s, I made a pilgrimage out to the University of California at Davis. Jack has passed away now, but he was an extraordinary man. He's Native American or was a professor of Native American studies at UC Davis. And he wrote a book called Columbus and Other Cannibals. And when I read, And when I read that book, which is just a short little thing. In fact, when he died, it went out of print, and I started, you know, I wrote about it in the last hours, and I started talking about it on the air, and somebody brought it back into print, you know, which is just great. I forget the guy's name, but he sent me an email saying, you turned me on to this book, and I'm going to, you know, get it back in print, and he did. And in that book, Forbes had done this really, really spectacular job of compiling all these contemporaneous histories of Columbus and how he treated the Taino people and exterminated them by 1555, at least on the island of Hispaniola. And so the, you know, the net of what I learned out of all this was that guns made possible this, you know, enslavement of the New World, literally all around the world, and the mass slaughter, the genocide, the world's largest genocide, the largest genocide in the history of the world, 50 to 100 million Native Americans killed in North America, you know, probably only seconded by the genocide of Native people in Australia, and then maybe thirded by the genocide of Jews and others in Germany, at least in you know, the history of the last few hundred years. And one of the things I find fascinating is that the genocide was so complete and so comprehensive in North America and in Australia. I have not been able to figure out why. Other countries colonized other places, you know, Belgium and the Congo, you know, France and Algeria, Spain and virtually all of Central and South America, but they never did a comprehensive genocide. They didn't kill all the natives. There are still lots and lots of Africans in Africa. There's still lots and lots of ancestors of the Mayans and the Aztecs in Central and South America. But you can travel across North America or across Australia for days and visit, you know, dozens and dozens of cities. And you know, certainly there's still Native Americans and Aboriginal Australians around, but they can be damn hard to find. And that was an intentional policy that was done by the citizens of basically one country, the United Kingdom. And I don't speculate that about this in the book so much. I just kind of point it out. But I've always wondered why. And, I, you know, maybe it's that all these other countries are not little tiny islands where, you know, if they want to spread their seed, as it were, they really need to occupy a new country. Or maybe there's something unique to you know, British culture. I just don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm curious about Captain Cook in Hawaii. You know, I don't know that the native populations were decimated there. Don't know.
He was more of an explorer. I mean, you know, go ahead. I'm sorry, Steve.
No, I'm just curious about that. It is actually curious because the doctrine of discovery, I mean, after all, Columbus, you know, he did his best to get, you know, to enslave 1,600 people. And it might be that the native peoples were simply not useful as slaves. They didn't follow that programming. Maybe that's the reason. But it's something for us to really think about. I was introduced to the doctrine of discovery by my friend Steve Newcomb, who's a Native American scholar and attorney who's done extensive research on it. And in a certain regard, the brutality, the total brutality of it is something that, you know, we don't recognize how much our country has been built on dominate or be dominated. And, you know, as you were telling me before the show, you know, you encountered some threatening people in the course of your book tour, and it might be that, you know, white people are thinking maybe they're going to get rear-ended by their own karma, you know, and they fear the retribution when people find out exactly how total this destruction was. And of course, as you point out in the book, and you might want to talk more about this, the this will also bring us to, you know, how the Second Amendment came about, the relationship between guns and slavery. And it's obvious, but you really put it in such a way that it really, you know, becomes something, wow, I never thought of it that way, and how important.
Yeah, well, to start with, you know, why the Second Amendment, and if I neglect to get back around to guns and slavery, please remind me. But at the founding of the Republic, of our Republic, there was an absolute consensus among both the founders, the people who fought the Revolutionary War, and the framers, the people who wrote the Constitution a generation later, that or a half generation later, anyway, that a standing army was a bad thing. These guys were, and I say guys because they were all men, were students of European history, and they knew that country after country after country, all the way back to, you know, Sumeria 7,000 years ago, had been overthrown from within by their own standing armies during times of peace. And so they actually wrote into the Constitution the only limit on the taxing and spending power of Congress in the entire Constitution, the only time limit, is in Article 1, Section 8, and it has to do with the Army, that, you know, Congress can appropriate tariffs or taxes for anything it wants, for as long as it wants. It can spend money for anything it wants, as long as it wants. As long as it satisfies the general welfare, which is the beginning and end of Article 1, Section 8, the Enumerated Powers Clause. But for the Army, Congress may not appropriate money for more than a two-year period. And this was because they wanted every single Congress gets reset every 2 years, as you know. They wanted every single Congress to have to confront the question, do we still want to have an Army? Now, you could fund the Navy forever because they wanted to protect shipping lanes and the borders, but the Army needed to be revisited every 2 years. So that was already written into the Constitution in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787. A year or so later, when they wrote the first drafts of the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments of the Constitution, the Second Amendment came about as a way of trying to answer the question, okay, if we get rid of our Army, how do we protect ourselves? I mean, keep in mind, you had, you know, in the North, you had the British controlled Canada. In the South, you had Florida was controlled by the Spanish, and Louisiana was controlled by the French. All along the western frontier of all of the eastern seaboard states, which was all the states of America at that time, there were a bunch of very seriously pissed off Indians. And so how do we protect ourselves? And the answer to that was state militias. The individual states had had militias going back, you know, easily 100 years before the founding of the Republic. And in the North, at the time of the Constitution, in the North, they were just that. They were state militias. They were very much like, you know, their descendants today, the National Guard. You know, they get together once a month and they kept all the weapons in the armory and all that kind of stuff. In the South, though, the state militias played three roles. The first was they were the militia of the state, as mentioned. The second was they were the slave patrols, and we can get into that in some detail. I think you got a break coming up here.
Yeah.
And the third was they were the police. Outside of one or two big cities in the South, the police were also the slave patrols, and modern policing in the South grew out of the slave patrols, which is why if you are shot and killed in the South, odds are 1 in 3 you were shot and killed by a stranger. Odds are 1 in 3 you were shot and killed by a cop. And so we can get into the slave patrols, which is, I'm not sure where your breaks are coming. But
good, the break is coming. The break should be here right now. And when we get back, we'll be back. How about that? Isn't that amazing? We'll be back with Tom Hartman talking about guns. Steve Behrman on WikiPolitiki back after these messages.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
Okay. 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Well, very interesting, that last commercial, which is about End Family Fire, and real messages from people who had a loved one accidentally be shot. I want to say something about, Tom, about the South and so on. You know, over time, there's been this insistence that the quote-unquote war between the states, which is what the South like to call it, the war between the states was about states' rights. But you prove in this book, and particularly in your last statement about the essential function of the militia, that no matter who it was living in the South, you were enrolled in the peculiar institution of slavery. So say more about that and how that played out during the assassination of Lincoln, the Reconstruction, and so on.
Yeah. Well, by the way, fun fact about Abraham Lincoln. Do you know what he signed into being the morning of the day that he went to Ford Theater and was assassinated?
I don't, but maybe it was a gun control law.
It was the U.S. Secret Service.
Oh, my goodness. Ah, talk
Isn't
about
that
bad
ironic?
Time. Ah, bad timing.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to laugh, but it's very bad timing. But yeah. Thank you for that tidbit.
Yeah, I love history trivia. In fact, I learned that from a Jack Reacher book, or a Lee Child book, rather, excuse me.
Yeah.
The way I lay it out in the book, I mean, people say, oh, no, states' rights, it was this, it was that, it was, the banks in the North, quack, quack, quack. All you have to do is read the South Carolina Declaration of Secession. I mean, it starts right out, and I quote it in the book. I don't have it in front of me, so I'll just have to paraphrase it, but basically it says that, we're a slave state. The North wants to take away our slaves. We're not going to put up with it. We're seceding from the Union. I mean, it's just that's the bottom line. And that was echoed in the secession statements of most of the southern states. So, the Civil War was about slavery, period, full stop. There's no way around that.
Yeah. And there's a lot of reframing. There's a lot of reframing going on. There's a lot of reframing going on these days about all of this stuff, including the Second Amendment and so on. When did
well,
this
let me, let me,
whole
if I
thing?
Could, if I
yeah,
could,
go ahead.
If I could finish the how the Second Amendment led to this, the modern version of it came along. Where we left our heroes, before the last break. was that all of the framers were of a mind that they wanted to make sure that ultimately America would not have a standing army during time of peace because of the threat of a military coup. And in the northern states, they had actually well-regulated militias. And well-regulated back in that time was a phrase that meant properly functioning, orderly. It did not mean some regulatory force. It meant doing what they're supposed to do. And, they would get together and drill, and, like I said, once a month. But in the South, they had these three purposes, being the police, being the slave patrols, and also being the state militias. And so in the South, they didn't just meet once a month. They ran continuously, 24-7, 365, every white male, 17 to 47 years old in most of the southern states, and some of them extended all the way up to 52 years old, and, et cetera. But basically, this was from the Georgia Constitution, the one that I quote in the book, 17 to 47, had to be a member of a slave patrol, and the slave patrols were continuously operating. There was always somebody on the road, riding on a horse with a gun, looking for runaway slaves. But the Georgia Constitution required that every slave quarter, the quarters of literally the bedding and possessions of every single slave in the state, had to be inspected at least once a month by the local slave patrols. So
make sure there were no weapons, huh?
Exactly. Specifically, it even mentions weapons. Yes, looking for weaponry, because the slave uprisings were actually happening with a fairly high frequency. Nobody wants to be enslaved. They were almost never mentioned in the newspapers because they didn't want anybody to get any ideas, but they were constant and they were persistent and they were very troublesome to the people in the South, to the white people in the South. So we get to the Virginia Ratifying Convention in the summer or fall of 1789. And several states had already ratified the Constitution. I think there were a couple that had not yet. But Virginia was really the linchpin state. Virginia was right in the middle, up and down the East Coast. It was the home of most of the founders and framers of great consequence. Most of them came from either Virginia, Massachusetts, or Pennsylvania, kind of in that order. And Ben Franklin had come from Pennsylvania, but he left the state when he was 17 because you had the ratifying convention in Virginia. James Madison brings forward let me just finish the story about Ben Franklin. He left Massachusetts. He was born in Massachusetts. Massachusetts was the only state that was functionally a theocracy. And you had to pay taxes to the church. If you didn't go to church on a Sunday, they'd come and arrest you. And that's why Ben Franklin left when he was 17 and went to Pennsylvania or Philadelphia. And he wrote about that at some length in his autobiography.
True deist as he was. True Rosicrucian and Mason. Yeah, okay.
Yes.
So back to Virginia, pivotal moment.
Yeah. So here we are in Virginia, and they're having this ratifying convention, and Madison brings along the most recent version of the Constitution and the most recent version of the Bill of Rights, which was still kind of in flux. I mean, the Bill of Rights wasn't ratified until 1791, at that time, the Second Amendment, which was the attempt to answer the question, if we don't have an army, what do we have? And the answer, of course, was each state has a militia that Congress in Article 1, Section 8 can call up, or that the president in Article 2 can call up, with permission of the Congress, or in the event of, an internal rebellion, even without permission of Congress. The Second Amendment said, for the security of a free country, et cetera, et cetera, right? And so the largest slaveholder in the state of Virginia gets quite bent out of shape about this. And his name was Patrick Henry. He's most famous for saying, give me liberty or give me death. But he owned more slaves than any other plantation owner or slaveholder in the state. And he was a famous and well-known orator. So Patrick Henry gets up and he gives this wild speech. And again, I'm sorry I don't have the book in front of me or I'd act it out for you, but it's worth reading on the air with some good drama. And he says, this Constitution gives both Congress, and I'm wildly paraphrasing here now, basically gives both Congress and the president the power to call up our militia, our Virginia militia, which, by the way, is our slave patrol, and move them somewhere else. You know, if there's a whiskey rebellion in Massachusetts, or if the British invade us from Canada, we could find the Virginia militia being sent up to Canada. Well, for Massachusetts or New York or Rhode Island, that was no big deal. I mean, they could get along fine without their militia for a few months or even for a few years. But in Virginia, if the militia had to leave the state, you know, as Patrick Henry pointed out, there were almost 300,000 people of African ancestry in Virginia. And he was looking at the probability of having his and his family's throats cut. I mean, you know, statewide rebellion. And so he stands up and he says, you know, if we ever get a Northerner or an abolitionist as president, or if the Northerners or the abolitionists ever take over Congress, then they can call up our militia and send it out of state, and we are doomed. I mean, we're dead. And ironically, Steve, this is, by the way, exactly what Abraham Lincoln did. I mean, Patrick Henry was president.
Yeah.
or you know, he could see which way the wind was blowing. And so he said, therefore, he would not ratify the Second Amendment. He would have nothing to do with it. And Madison basically called him paranoid, said, come on, you know, there's nothing in this Constitution that's going to end slavery. And you know it, and I know it. I'm a slaveholder, and I'm a Virginian, and I helped write the damn thing. But Patrick Henry and George Mason along with him would not be satisfied by that. So the compromise that they came up with was to rewrite the Second Amendment to say for the security of a free state instead of for the security of a free country. And that way the primacy of the individual states, the you know, the first among equals, as it were, the first, you know, their ability to say we have first control over our militia and the federal government has second control, could be established. And so and that's the current version of the Second Amendment. And so in a very real way, while the first version of the Second Amendment was written to, you know, guard against a standing army during times or to provide for an alternative to a standing army, the current version of it was also written or was modified into its current version in order to protect the slave patrols of North and South Carolina, Virginia, and Georgia.
Very interesting. I really appreciate how you really unravel this whole yarn, because, you know, here we are, we're 100 and something years later, almost 200 years, 150 years after the Civil War, and the obfuscation and confusion is still going on. So we can just about, if you want to say something about post-Civil War America and the South and guns and so on, and how that led to this current NRA lobby, guns as a constitutional right to carry arms. How has that shifted, and why has the Second Amendment become so important?
Well, do you want to start with gun culture in the United States as it evolved post Civil War and in the Wild West and all that?
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah. Well, during the Civil War, there were, as is the case in all wars, tragically, there were some men who behaved very, very badly. They viewed war as essentially an opportunity and an excuse to literally rob people, you know, steal from their homes, the cities or areas that they defeated, to rape the women, very, very common. In fact, it's considered a spoil of war, or has been traditionally by many armies, and to kill people, just to murder people that they didn't like or they didn't want around or that they thought might represent a threat to them at some point in the future, including young men, or particularly young men. And among the Southerners, the James brothers came out of Missouri, but, you know, there were also the famous bushwhackers out of Missouri, but there were other.
This was not Henry and William James. This was not Henry and William James. It was Jesse James. Just the James brothers,
yeah.
A different James. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Henry and Williams, and William would be, you know, two great philosophers. One of them, a great psychologist, would be horrified by all this. But
yeah.
The Saturday Evening Post started publication, as I recall, in 1821. And after the Civil War, the Saturday Evening Post, and there were a few other imitators, and a lot of newspapers did this as well. They were looking for, but particularly the magazines, they were looking for stories that people would want to read. You know, they kind of serialized fiction, but not really call it fiction. And so there were these New York writers who would get stories about, you know, hey, the James Gang just robbed another bank in Kansas, or the Clyde so-and-so just did such-and-such somewhere. And, you know, I mean, they didn't know these people. They just knew the stories. I mean, it turns out that the shootout at the OK Corral was just, you know, a push, you know, it was somebody being shot in the back. But, you know, a lot of these things were just somebody shot in the back in an alley, and suddenly it becomes legend. Well, it became legend because these New York writers would write these elaborate, you know, heavily fictionalized stories about these people. But the way that they ended up out west, I mean, the Jameses were from Missouri to begin with, which was sort of out west back then. But the way that they ended up in the Wild West, a lot of them from the South, was, you know, when they came home, they fought in regiments alongside their neighbors. And their neighbors saw what these guys did during the war, that they were robbers and murderers and rapists. And when they came home, they were like, I don't want my kids growing up next door to that guy. And so they basically got kicked out of their own states. So they went out west to kind of reinvent themselves and start new lives, but they were still robbers, rapists, and murderers. And that's what they did. But we turned them into this thing of glory and of mystery, and throughout the late 1800s and the early 1920s, and then with the advent of the radio, with the radio dramas of the 1920s, and then television in the 1950s, we created this mythology around the gunslingers and the cowboys. The cowboys were basically one step above slave labor. They were poorly paid, overworked, died young. They were at the bottom of the labor pecking order in the West. But we ended up with shows like, you know, Gunsmoke and things like that. Or it wasn't just Matt Dillon. What was the show with Chester? That was Gunsmoke, wasn't it? Yeah.
Gunsmoke. That was Chester. Yeah. There was Have Gun Will Travel, many of these things. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, very little of this bore any resemblance to reality. In fact, Wyatt Earp had a sign outside Tombstone that said, check your gun at the sheriff's office and get a receipt. Gun control was widely practiced across the Old West. And there frankly weren't that many guns outside of the people who had fought in the Civil War, who still had their weaponry from the Civil War. And the reason for that was, up until 1856, when Mr. Colt began with money from Eli Whitney, the cotton gin inventor and billionaire of his time, I mean, in today's dollars, until Colt kind of started his second run at mass manufacturing guns, guns were, you know, made one at a time. They were very expensive. A gun could cost as much as a house. They were up until the 1850s, they were made out of typically fairly soft metal. After a gun had been fired 30 or 40 times, it was pretty much useless. In fact, it was dangerous. It would blow back and take your hand off. And, so, you know, this whole mythology thing, really was made out of not entirely whole cloth, but, you know, it was about as close to reality as Batman is. Well, a little closer, but you get my point. So that,
yeah, okay, so well, we're going to take a break, believe it or not. And then we're going to talk about the present time. Thank you, Tom, for filling us in on gun history. Steve Behrman with Wiki Politiki. We'll be back very shortly.
Thank you. Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network, presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Okay, Steve Behrman back with Tom Hartman. We're talking about guns and the Second Amendment. So there's three things I want to cover in this last 15 or 20 minutes. And first of all, where we are now, how we got to this current notion of the Second Amendment. Then we also want to hear about your very sensible plan that would essentially allow people to keep their guns, but regulate them in a very significant way, and then how we get there from here. So on we go.
Okay, so to start out, where do you want to start?
Let's start with
how we got
the current view of the Second Amendment. Yeah, how we got to the current view of the Second Amendment.
Okay, well, it was sort of a three-step process. Number one, in 1976, the Supreme Court, for the very first time in the history of the United States, decided in a decision called Buckley versus Vallejo that the First Amendment right to protect, that protects free speech, that didn't just apply to things that you said or things that you wrote, but that also applied to the spending of money, that spending money for political purposes to buy politicians, to own politicians, to buy legislation, that all of those things were protected First Amendment rights. This is pretty shocking stuff. And so what followed that was, you know, just this explosion of political activity on the right, the creation of the Heritage Foundation, and 2 years earlier, Lewis Powell, 3 years earlier, had suggested this in 71 in the Powell memo. The Cato Institute, the American Enterprise Institute, all these groups. The following year in 77, the NRA was basically taken over from within by the gun industry. And prior to that, I mean, I remember, you know, being a Cub Scout in the late 50s, early 60s, and, you could get a shooting merit badge, a gun safety merit badge, and the NRA came in, and a local guy who was a local NRA guy came in and he taught the classes. And that's what they did. The NRA was actually in favor of gun control until 1977. Mm-hmm. As was George Herbert Walker Bush, and as was Ronald Reagan, and the Republican Party, for that matter. So in 77, the NRA basically got taken over and by the weapons industry and turned into a front group for one particular manufacturing industry that at that time was a multi-million-dollar industry and is now a billion-dollar industry. They then began funding, quote, scholars, people like John Lott, I used to debate him on my program all the time, and others who would come up with these wild ideas about why the Second Amendment was created, ranging from the individual right to protect yourself, which is what the Supreme Court ultimately decided in the Heller decision in 2008 after years and years of, you know, lobbying and aggressive publication by the NRA and their friends, to this bizarre idea that was first floated in the NRA magazine, The Rifleman, The American Rifleman, back in the 70s, that the founders actually wrote the Second Amendment so that if our government ever became oppressive, we could overthrow it, which is, absurd on its face and is completely ahistoric. There's no reference of any kind like that anywhere in any of the founding documents or the debates. So, that corporate money came in with the Supreme Court's blessing, and they began buying politicians one at a time. They used to own probably as many Democrats as Republicans over the last couple of decades. That shifted, and the Democrats kind of started moving away from that. And now, basically, the NRA owns the Republican Party and a few Democrats, mostly the ones who call themselves Blue Dogs and what we all used to call Republicans. that got us to where we are right now. I mean, you know, it led right to the Heller decision, you know, where the Supreme Court said, oh, we magically discovered this was Scalia's scam, you know, and now you've got five guys on the court who all claim the scam, this original scam. They say that they can read the minds of the founders. Now, this is like the guys, the televangelists who say, you know, God told me, I read God's mind, and God told me that you need to send me money so I can have $54 million for a new jet. It's just as much a scam when Scalia says, well, I know what the founders meant. They meant this. Well, no, he's just BSing you. But he dressed it up in a lot of flowery language and some quotes from the founding times, none of which had to do with the Second Amendment. And here we are. So then,
you know,
the second point,
it really is about money, isn't it?
I'm sorry.
It really is about money in politics. That's really the whole conversation. So into this context, because we may have a shot to perhaps change things, you've come up with what I thought is a simple and brilliant solution based on science that would protect gun owners' rights and the rights of the rest of us to not be gunned down. So you're proposing a sane world. Obviously, you're crazy, but go ahead and tell us what it is.
Okay. Well, there's several different solutions in the book. I'm assuming you're talking about the car one.
I'm talking about the car one. I'm also talking about the distinctive identity of both of those. I think they both
things.
Make sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, to deal with the latter one first, then, a company in Germany and a company in Switzerland have come up with two new kinds of guns that are basically like, you know, a lot of the modern cars nowadays, you walk up to your car and you just touch it. And as long as you have an RFID chip and a fob in your pocket or in your purse, the car recognizes you and unlocks and will start up and drive away with you in it. I think it was the company in Germany invented a car or a gun, rather, that will not fire unless the person holding the gun is also either wearing an RFID chip, they sell a watch and a ring to go along with the gun, or has it in their pocket like a key fob. Similarly, a company, as I recall, in Austria or Switzerland came up with a gun that recognizes your palm print. I didn't know until I was researching this book that our palm prints are totally unique, just like our fingerprints. And so the detector is built right into the grip of the gun, into the handle of the gun, and it recognizes you. And if you're not you, that gun is just it's a lightweight boat anchor. You know, it doesn't do anything. And so in both cases, interestingly, a couple of different companies have tried to import these kinds of guns into the United States. And every single time they've tried, they've been a couple of them were run out of business. Others just stopped trying to import these guns because of all the death threats they were getting. So these kinds of guns, these technological solutions are widely available in Europe where people can own guns and their kids are not accidentally killing each other, but they're not available here in the United States. So that's number one. And then the car solution is pretty straightforward. Back in the 1920s, you could buy a car and drive it without a driver's license. You didn't have to demonstrate you knew how to drive or anything else. And the problem was that cars were becoming more and more popular. The roads were getting more and more congested. And people were dying in car accidents by, you know, by accident, but people were dying. Cars were not designed to kill people like guns are. They were designed for transportation, but still they were killing people. So the question was, how do we set up a system so that cars don't kill people? Or if they do, we know who to hold responsible. And they came up with this three-part system of registration, license, and insurance. Very simple. You have to register the car, the vehicle ID number from the time it's made until the time it's destroyed. And every year you have to renew that registration with the state so that we, the people, always know who's responsible for that car. We could do the same thing with guns. Every gun made has a serial number. They're required to have serial numbers. They have been since the 1930s. This would be easy. Number two, the license. If you want to drive a car, you have to prove to an estate employee you know how to drive. You take a driver's test. You also have to prove that you know the laws around driving. You take a written test. In most states, if you want to get a concealed carry permit, you have to do the same thing. You have to sit, you know, you have to go to a gun range with a state employee. Typically, they're done at the state police offices, and demonstrate your proficiency at using a weapon safely and competently. And then you also have to take a written test to show that you know what the laws are around. If we simply applied those same rules to every gun rather than only concealed carry guns, I think that we would end up with a lot fewer irresponsible gun owners and a whole lot more well-educated and competent gun owners. And then number three, the liability insurance. This is one the Republicans love because it's a so-called free market solution. That is that you and I, Steve, even as good liberals, don't want the government snooping into our lives with the purpose of trying to anticipate whether we're going to commit a crime. I mean, that's George Orwell stuff. But there is an entire industry that does just that, and we're all just fine with it. It's called the insurance industry. If you want to buy, life insurance, they're going to ask you, do you smoke? In fact, last time I tried to buy life insurance, they sent a nurse out to my house to draw blood. I mean, they're literally looking inside my body to try and figure out what their risks are. If you want to buy car insurance, the liability insurance, they're going to ask, you know, they're going to check. They're not even going to take your word for it. They're going to check with the state and see how many tickets do you have? You know, what kind of driver are you? If you want to buy health insurance, they'll check into your health. So, you know, pretty straightforward stuff. And I think it's so ironic that if the kids in Newtown, if Adam Lanza, you know, the mass murderer in Newtown, if he had, instead of killing those kids with an AR-15, if he'd mowed them down crossing a crosswalk with a SUV intentionally, maliciously, even Geico would be paying out $1 million to each one of their families. But because he killed them with a gun, their families didn't even get burial expenses. And several of those families got really badly wiped out. You know, the breadwinners couldn't go back to work for some time. They lost their jobs, so all kinds of terrible things. And so this is a way of having a private for-profit industry determine who's safe and who's not, you know, doing something that the insurance industry has been doing since the 1920s when E.F. Stone essentially invented the modern insurance industry. And started offering car insurance, by the way, and although he started with life insurance. And, I think this would work.
Well, you know, here we are. We've got another couple of minutes left. But here we are at the point where it certainly seems like the NRA is having some problems. Is this does this portend finally a change in the gun laws? And how do we bring that about?
I think it does. In 1995, the most powerful lobby in D.C. was the tobacco lobby. Mike Pence was writing op-eds about how tobacco doesn't cause cancer, and the tobacco executives were all proclaiming that nicotine was not an addictive drug. In fact, they all lied through their teeth and testified to that effect to Congress. By 1998, there had been all these lawsuits, and in the discovery process in the lawsuits, we discovered that the tobacco industry had been lying through their teeth for years. And by 2000, 2001, the tobacco lobby was just another lobby. I think the exact same thing is happening with the NRA right now, as we're discovering that they have been lying through their teeth to us for decades about the consequences of guns. They bought off politicians and got the Dickey Amendment in effect, for example, which makes it a crime for the federal government to even compile statistics on gun gun deaths in the United States and gun safety in the United States. We're learning how malicious and how corrupt the NRA has been over the years, and it's devastating their reputation. And to the point that you've got these internal wars now going on inside the NRA. And I think, 5 years from now, we're going to look back and say the NRA went down, in that cycle, 2017 to 2021, more or less, the same way the tobacco industry went down between 1997 and 2001.
May it be so. Yeah. I really like that you have put together this book, The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment, because I found myself educated by it. And once you start to put these things in context, now, of course, right now, there are people like the people in Oregon who are the legislators who have fled, the truckers who are gathered around. And there's a contingent of people who really do believe that they have to keep their guns so that because they're going to have to fight their government for freedom. And just as you pointed out in your book, when Obama was elected president, there was all of this rumor and fear-mongering that he's going to take all our guns away and all of that. In the final minute, how do we deal with that massive campaign of what I would call impropaganda?
Well, the black man now in the White House is going to take away your guns was so pervasive that there's a Wikipedia page for the great ammunition shortages of 2008 and 2012. They both happened in December of those years, right after Obama got elected and reelected. If a Democrat is elected in 2020, God willing, it'll probably happen again. Education. This book. It's a little book. It's only 197 pages. It's a quick read. You can read it in a day. It's the first in a series, by the way, of hidden history books. The next one will be out in October about the Supreme Court and the betrayal of America. Mm-hmm. And I would say, read it or listen again to this interview. And start sharing the information with your friends and neighbors. It's we need an uprising, Steve.
Thank you, Tom. It's such a pleasure to have you. Tom Hartman, he's got a new book, The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment. Other hidden histories will come out. Thank you for being a great educator. Tom Hartman, this is Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki. We'll be back with you next week.